This event is an outgrowth of an event we had in Amman earlier in the year, in which we put together an international conference on the sanctions on Iraq in the 1990s. And I'm someone who has worked in Iraq for a very long time, and although we were not allowed to work because of the sanctions during the 90s, I still went into Iraq just about every year and saw the effect the sanctions were having on the country. And the effect was devastating. And many, many stories can be told about how this is expressed. Things like my former student, who was a professor at the university, wanted to invite me to dinner, and I was quite unhappy to have that happen because he was going to have a chicken, and the chicken was his month's salary. This is how bad this stuff was. And sanctions are a very blunt weapon. They always hurt the poor, the old, the young, and the last people to be hurt are the ruling regimes. And we, as Americans, we know that our government is very, very eager to put sanctions on country after country after country, and no good comes of it. Our speakers tonight are two very distinguished people, both of whom have written books on the subject of the sanctions, and they come at it from very, very different points of view. Hans von Sponeck, who will speak first, received his education in Germany, the UK, and the US, including in Louisiana and Hawaii. He holds a PhD from the University of Marburg. He served in the United Nations for 32 years. His assignments included head of mission in Botswana, Pakistan, and India. He was UNDP director, European office in Geneva, coordinator for Iraq at rank of a UN assistant secretary general, which is how he comes to this subject. He's the author of A Different Kind of War on the Iraq sanctions. He is currently teaching at the University of Marburg. He has brought with him a copy of a book, which is the result of a conference that he and I were both attending in last year in Ghent. The book is called Beyond Educide, Sanctions, Occupation, and the Struggle for Higher Education in Iraq, and it deals with the destruction of the higher education system, in fact, the entire education system in Iraq, and the devastating effect that has had. I mean, the sanctions have a tremendous effect that will last many, many more years than the wars that have happened, because we have a whole generation which is essentially about half educated. The second speaker tonight was Joy Gordon, she is the author of Invisible War, The United States and the Iraq Sanctions, Harvard University Press, listed by Foreign Policy as one of the best books published in 2010. She has also published in Le Monde Diplomatique, Ethics and International Affairs, Global Governance, Arab Studies Quarterly, and the Chicago Journal of International Law. She teaches in the Philosophy Department at Fairfield University in Connecticut, and her work can be found at www.invisiblewar.net. And at this point, have come to this podium Hans von Sponeck.
Well, I must first of all thank the University of Chicago very much, and in particular Professor McGuire Gibson for having us here. And I want to thank also you for the interest that you have in coming in this rainy afternoon to hear a hot subject, at least hot to me. And it's not only a hot subject, but it's also hot in this room. And therefore, you allow me if I take my jacket off. And I'll just throw it here like that. Yes, we have a division of labor, Professor Gordon and I, and we have little time. And it's a topic that is so complex. So forgive me if I have to rush through some issues where one should spend more time. But maybe you will have questions, and I can come back to some of the issues that are relevant here. I want to start by reminding myself, ourselves, that it all started very legal. In 1990, on the 2nd of August, when Iraq invaded, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and the United Nations Security Council reacted to that by imposing sanctions. And on the 17th of January 1991, after failed negotiations between the Iraqis and the United States, led by James Baker on the U.S. side and by Mr. Tariq Aziz, Deputy Prime Minister of Iraq, on the Iraqi side, a war, Operation Desert Storm, started at that time. That was also legal. You cannot move into somebody else's country and expect impunity. And this is a reference to 1991. I leave it up to you whether it is also a reference to 2003. But what is not so, that's just by the way of background. What I want very much to look at with you is what happened during these 13 ensuing years from 1990 until 2003, when 24 million Iraqis were subjected to the most comprehensive economic sanctions that a country ever had to endure. There is no comparable example, at least not a multilateral example of this kind. What happened? And yes, we are in an academic setting, but it's not just of academic interest. It is also not just of historic interest. It is very much of interest and relevance to the kind of international relations we are seeing today. It had an impact on how the world relates to each other during these years and today, in fact. It also is a challenge to become finally a little bit more serious in developing an international security architecture which really succeeds in protecting the innocents, which tries to calm our earth a little bit. Doesn't look very good right now, but anyway, there's a need for a UN reform and whatever has to be done to improve that security architecture. And the third element is for sure, I hope to all of us, is to make a case for the fact that justice and accountability isn't just for the loser. Accountability and justice relate to everybody. Law is applicable to the weak, to the strong, to anybody. And my next point, and it's a very important point to me, is the point about the gap. Now, what gap am I talking about? The group of five permanent ambassadors to the United Nations in 1995 that had absolutely nothing to do with Iraq specifically, but it has everything to do with what ultimately happened in Iraq under sanctions. The five ambassadors, including Madeleine Albright, as the U.S. representative, and Serge Lavrov, the today's Russian foreign minister, who at the time when I was in Baghdad served as his country's permanent representative to the United Nations, five ambassadors from China, France, the U.K., Russia, and Great Britain, thank you, yes, and the U.K., made the point that when the international community imposes sanctions on a country, any country, they should keep in mind that it is a first order of priority that the innocent population is protected, number one. Number two, that humanitarian supplies to help people survive in this country, in these countries of under sanctions, that these humanitarian supplies come into the country efficiently and without any hindrance. That was a very important statement made by the Security Council. And then, well, as the years passed and Iraq suffered, the Iraqi people suffered under sanctions, in the year 2000, I, in fact, was still in Baghdad as the UN Iraq, the UN humanitarian coordinator in Baghdad. The ambassador of Malaysia, Mr. Agam Hazmi, made the following statement. That's the second document that I hoped you would have to understand the immense importance of that gap between that statement that I referred to a moment ago and what actually happened in Iraq, with the full consent, if not the full support of the UN Security Council. And I want to read these few lines, it's not long. He said, "How ironic is it that the same policy that is supposed to disarm Iraq of its weapons of mass destruction has itself become a weapon of mass destruction." That was an accusation, a very powerful accusation, of the institution, the UN Security Council, of which Malaysia at that time was a member. Well, one of the US previous presidents, John Adams, made that statement, which of course one smiles about, but it's a very important statement, and that is, facts are very stubborn things. And these stubborn things, one can identify facts as far as Iraq under sanctions is concerned. I cannot go into too much detail, but I want to mention a few. I saw them. It's not that I read it in a book or I listened to an Iraqi friend or whatever. I saw the mental and physical well-being in shambles in Iraq. Physical violence, despair when you had no money, when you had nothing, when you were hungry, when you maybe were an orphan, or you had to be a prostitute, in the daytime a student, in the evening something else. So mental and physical well-being severely deteriorated, malnutrition enormously increased. 30% of the children under 5 in Iraq at the time when I was there were malnourished. Diseases that Iraq, as a rich country, Iraq was a wealthy country before the sanctions. Diseases had resurfaced that were long forgotten before. Kwashiorkor, a vitamin-related deficiency. Cholera, dysentery. All became rampant and epidemic in their widespread extent. Child mortality. UNICEF carried out an analysis during those years and it skyrocketed. Among the highest, higher than Afghanistan for a while, higher than Sierra Leone, higher than some of the other West African countries. Between 120 and 130 children per 1,000 under 5 were dying for reasons that were unacceptable, for reasons that linked not to a dictator, but linked to the organization in which I served for 32 years. There were other areas that one can identify. There is usable data. Some is more valuable, some is more reliable, but there were data also on unemployment. We in the UN considered between 60 and 70% of the people were unemployed. That should have worked. There was prostitution. I referred to this. There were orphans. Orphanages arose. And then you will say, and one has to say, yes, what were really the causes for all that? If I wouldn't bring in here the fact that, yes, Saddam Hussein was a cause, but don't mix in that cocktail what he did that was bad and what we did that was bad. In the United Nations, in the international community, one can very, very much identify the fact that we had a lot to do on the international side with these developments in Iraq. The one I want to mention, just to put things a bit into perspective, allowable or inadequate allowable finance. The UN Security Council was very tight, very hard in limiting the amount of oil that Iraq could sell in order to pay for the oil for food program of which I was the head. Now just four figures, try to remember them. Three of these figures you can read in UN documents. The fourth one you cannot, because the UN didn't extrapolate or didn't bring it down to the lowest possible figure that would make you and I understand the dismal situation in Iraq better. The figures are as follows. Iraq sold or was allowed to sell in 6.5 years of oil for food program $64 billion worth of oil. Out of that, 43 billion were allowed to be used for humanitarian supplies. The difference, we can talk about it, I can explain it easily to you. What actually arrived in Iraq was $28 billion worth of humanitarian supplies. Another big gap between 43 that they could have spent and 28 that they did spend. I can explain that also very easily, and in a moment I will at least make a reference to that. If you, and that's what the UN reports did not mention, where if you then break that down to a per person, per day, amount of resources, help, items that were needed for survival, you get what is less than what you have paid this afternoon for a cup of coffee. 51 cents is what per person per day came into Iraq during these 6.5 years. And you can say, oh, so what? Well, if I tell you that between 60 and 70% of the Iraqi people during those years were needed, were dependent on what came into Iraq, then you will understand why this is such a horrifically inadequate figure, which could have really be changed very easily by the UN Security Council if that council had wanted to do that. There was an immense bureaucratization of the procurement of supplies. A bottle of water from, let's say, Chicago to be exported to Iraq, it's not a great example because they had also their own water, but any item, that's the point I want to make, that was exported, or rather imported into Iraq under the Oil for Food Program, sanction program, had to go through 23 steps before it was released and could reach the Iraqi people. Even the Ministry of Defense in the UK or in Germany had to clear. The foreign ministries, the missions to the United Nations, the UN Secretariat, the logistical companies, the shipping agent, it took 23 distinct, at least 23 distinct steps before that item would finally arrive. That explains to some extent the difference between 43 billion that were available and 28 that were actually utilized. So Professor Gordon will expand on the reasons for that, which relate to a large extent to the Sanctions Committee of the UN Security Council. Items were blocked. Billions, not millions, billions of dollars worth of humanitarian supplies were held back, were blocked. They were waiting in Amman, or they were waiting at the Turkish border, or they were waiting elsewhere in Europe or North America for shipment, for transport into Iraq, and they were not allowed to come in for various acceptable, no, for various unacceptable reasons, ridiculous reasons, as Professor Gordon will tell us. For every dollar that Iraq earned that could have been used for humanitarian supplies, 30 cents, a third, were diverted and put into a budget in Geneva called the UN Compensation Commission. The Compensation Commission processed claims of individuals, of firms, and of governments, mainly the Kuwait government, of claims that they had for losses that they incurred as a result of Iraq's invasion into Kuwait. Well, there's nothing wrong with that, except at a time when I told you the child mortality rate was skyrocketing, that money was needed to make young people and others survive, have the medicines, have the help, and it wasn't done. I hope that no one in this room will disagree with me when I say when you are in a country that suffers, whether under sanctions or whatever, every human being is of equal standing. Your background is irrelevant. You are there, you are alive, and you need. Why did we in the UN resort to a reimbursement, or rather to a support of Arabs in Iraq with less funding than Kurds that lived in northern Iraq? The Kurds that lived in Baghdad, fine, they were treated like Arabs. But if you lived on the other side of the Green Line, you received much more than the Arabs that lived south of the Green Line. 19% of the revenue that became available under the Oil for Food program reached 13% of the people in northern Iraq. That isn't fair. Who said anything? Well, we said it. In the UN, we were quite, as UN international, UN diplomats, we were much too shy in voicing our outrage over some of these things. When we said this, they said, hold it, you don't understand. This is affirmative action. The Kurds have suffered for a long time under Saddam Hussein. They now need more. I appreciate that to some extent, but not in a situation where there was such an inadequate funding available and people were suffering. So all of that goes to show how difficult, how tough the circumstances were with the full control of the UN Security Council. They could have done something about that. And what is a little bit more difficult to understand, but I will try to explain it, is a major problem that we faced in the United Nations at the time in the Secretariat was where these, what we call the consensus resolutions. These are resolutions passed by the Security Council that look good to everybody. The wording is fine. Just like if you look at the most recent consensus resolutions on Libya, they look fine. But if there is a hidden agenda and you interpret what you read in a different way or in a way that is selfish, that is nationalistic, rather than in the interest of the people in the country, for example, Iraq, then it becomes a different picture. And I want to give you three examples here of three resolutions very quickly that make the point that I just made. When you read in a resolution that was passed in 1991, for example, that sanctions on Iraq would be lifted if Iraq had completed all actions, what does that mean? I ask you, all actions, you will give me one answer. I ask you, you will give me another answer. That's not very helpful. That's that consensus resolution, which is politically convenient. You can hide behind it, and you can interpret it any way you want. The same is another resolution, a very important one that was passed in 1999, where the wording was, sanctions against Iraq will be lifted if Iraq has cooperated in all respects. What does that mean? Cooperated in all respects. Again, subject to interpretation. And the most dangerous consensus resolution for Iraq that ultimately also explains why there was an invasion in March 2003 was the one that the UN Security Council passed in November of 2002, where the reading of this resolution was, if Iraq is in material breach, there will be serious consequences. Now, can you see material breach, serious consequences? The French had a totally different interpretation of that from the British and the Americans, and the Russians had still another one, the Chinese had another. There was a disarray of positions because it was a nicely worded, not so nicely from my vantage point, but an acceptable wording that could be interpreted. That was a very big problem because one could then do in devious and less devious, overt or covert, or whatever ways you could push, you could implement what you wanted as a nation, a government, I don't mean US, any of the 15 members of the UN Security Council. And I want to add and hurry here, the UN Secretariat wasn't innocent in all that. We as international civil servants should have had a lot, myself included, a lot more courage than we actually did. It was unacceptable, totally unacceptable, but we kept quiet for a long time, that the United Nations that had an office for humanitarian affairs, for reasons that I still do not understand today, created an office of the Iraq program, another office, while it should have been the Iraq program should have been part of the humanitarian office of the United Nations. It was divided. Why? One could control that better than the other. And the two also did not communicate with each other. We had today, he's a professor in Harvard. He was in the UN humanitarian office at the time when I was in the office of the Iraq program working in Baghdad, and he was told by his superiors, do not go across the hall because these people in this office of the Iraq program are too political. Too political. That's one United Nations. It's one body that did not get their act together. And it wasn't just that. It was more serious than that. You had four main players in implementing the Iraq program as far as the UN as an institution was concerned. You had the UN Disarmament Group. You had the UN Humanitarian Group, which I headed. You had the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights, a former foreign minister of the Netherlands who for 9 years hadn't been in Iraq, but tried to assess the Iraq human rights situation. And when we tried to remind him that we were in Baghdad, I had over 1,000 people in my office, we could have easily helped him in an at least informal way to write his report. We were told, no, he doesn't want that. And the last group was the compensation group. And isn't it, in a way, shocking? I hope it is shocking to you, it is to me, that these four components not one single time got together and tried to get the act together in the interest of doing what was in that letter to which I referred to that the UN Security Council had accepted as a generic statement on please protect the people in a country under sanctions. Well, I'm moving quickly now to the last piece of, I probably have already gone, I don't know, but I will have maybe 3 more minutes. Good. Options, there are many options that the UN Security Council had. The obvious one is it could immediately have added resources in order to improve the situation to the point where there was a halfway, at least a halfway, dignified survival possible for the Iraqi people. That didn't happen. There were many other items that I could list. The one with which I had to struggle more than with others was the fact that we again and again were confronted with not accidental, with purposely planted dis- and misinformation. Lies, straight for an American once said, don't say it in such a European discreet way of disinformation, just call it lies, he said. Well, yes, they were lies, which distorted the picture, which distorted the image that people had in Europe and in North America about the situation in Iraq. Very difficult. I can give you many. Example, we had a food distribution program according to which 440,000 tons of food would every month, it's a lot, 440,000 tons of food distributed in Iraq. And it worked not well, it worked excellently well. We had food monitors, our international staff, we looked at where the food was going and it was fine. That there were little hiccups, and sometimes maybe with a political twist, very small exceptions, not allowing the statement which one would read in Washington and in London that Saddam Hussein was trying to politicize this whole program and people that were not on his side wouldn't get the food. That was simply a lie. By saying that, I'm not in the pocket, as some in the media argued a few years ago, this guy, forget about him, he is in the pocket of Saddam Hussein. That's total, complete rubbish. I want to, before I'm coming really to an end, I want to really pay my respect here to the public in the U.S., and in many countries in Europe that were much stronger in voicing their anger, their discomfort over the way we in the Security Council, in the international community, in the General Assembly were handling the demands for protection of the Iraqi people. So in what was the end? The end, and that's my last two sentences, in the end, I remembered, and I stuck to this, I remembered what Immanuel Kant, German philosopher, said when he said, have the courage to use your own intellect And I took that courage to use my own intellect, and I said, if I continue to be part of that, then I will be part of that group, which ultimately must be blamed for a huge violation of international law that we performed in the context of Iraq. And the obvious next step was then to resign. And that I did, and I think I did the right thing for myself. That doesn't mean that I do not. I very much continue to believe in the United Nations, to believe in the UN Charter. But it must be that United Nations must be taken seriously and must be treated with respect and honesty. And if we don't do that, the UN will remain useless or weak as it is at this moment. Thank you very much.
What I'd like to do today is to give some detail about two of the processes that shaped the sanctions that Hans von Sponeck has just described. One is the 661 Committee, the committee of the UN Security Council, charged with implementing the sanctions on Iraq, and the other is the sanctions policymaking process within the U.S. government. In both cases, there was no public access and no meaningful accountability. This lack of transparency was a significant factor in making it possible for the sanctions to be maintained for so long at such a highly destructive level. The 661 committee met behind closed doors. They kept minutes of their meetings, but the minutes were restricted. For the most part, the minutes were not even circulated to the entire committee, only the five permanent members. For the first 5 years, the committee didn't even provide its agenda to its own committee members in advance of the meetings. There was no public knowledge of the committee's existence, let alone its decisions, for years. Although its original mandate was to report on the sanctions to the council, its primary function quickly came to be granting exemptions to the broad prohibitions on imports to allow Iraq to import humanitarian goods on a case-by-case basis. The U.S. took the most extreme position in opposing efforts to import humanitarian goods into Iraq. For the first 5 years of the sanctions, the U.S. view was sometimes shared by a few other countries on the Council, Britain, France, and a couple of elected members. But by 1995, no one agreed with the U.S. view, not even Britain. But it was possible for the U.S. to block these goods unilaterally because granting humanitarian exemptions required consensus, so any single country on the Council could block any goods for any reason. For example, Resolution 661 provided that Iraq could import medicines and, quote, in humanitarian circumstances, close quote, food. To make food purchases conditional in any form was unconscionable, given that Iraq had imported two-thirds of its food. While there were food rationing and incentives to increase agriculture, clearly Iraq was going to be unable to increase its agriculture enough to substitute for the massive canceled imports for at least a growing season. But in the fall of 1990, this requirement, in humanitarian circumstances, became a point of contention within the committee. Prior to the sanctions, Iraq had contracted with a Bulgarian company to purchase a delivery of powdered milk. The committee had a bitter argument over whether to allow the milk to be delivered, and the U.S. vetoed it. Its position was that humanitarian circumstances were not present unless, first, there was irrefutable evidence of, second, actual widespread famine. Others on the committee argued that since food is recognized as a basic human right in international law, food imports should be allowed into Iraq if there was any deprivation at all. But in the end, because of the consensus rule, the U.S. and U.K. successfully blocked all legal food imports into Iraq for 8 months, until March 1991. After the 1991 war, when UN reports described Iraq as near apocalyptic, others in the 661 committee pressed the U.S. to agree that several categories of imports should be allowed automatically: goods related to food production, health care, education, and the particular needs of women and children. The U.S. refused to do that. What happened instead was a gentleman's agreement, a verbal understanding that the committee would look favorably on those goods, or at least give a reason for their denial, rather than simply denying them arbitrarily. But the agreement was worthless. Before the ink was dry, so to speak, the U.S. was, for example, blocking fabric for burial shrouds on the grounds that fabric could be used to rebuild Iraq's military-industrial capacity. Throughout the entire sanctions period, Iraq was prohibited from importing most of the goods necessary for its infrastructure, for generating electricity, water treatment, telecommunications, roads, and bridges. The view of the U.S. was that all of these goods were dual use. Electrical generators could be used by the military, as could trucks, telephones, water pipes, laundry detergent, plywood, tractors, and tires. Consequently, even though all of these goods had obvious necessary humanitarian uses, the U.S. often vetoed them. It's worth noting that during this period, the U.S. State Department and administration issued any number of statements in which they reiterated again and again that the humanitarian crisis was due entirely to Saddam's corruption and the regime's failure to order goods. The State Department stated repeatedly that Iraq is free at any time to import all medicines, agricultural goods, and everything needed to meet humanitarian needs. These statements were issued at the same time that the U.S. was blocking antibiotics on the grounds that it might be used as an antidote to anthrax. The U.S. objected to atropine, which was required for any general surgery requiring anesthesia, obviously crippling the healthcare system's ability to meet urgent medical needs. The U.S. reasoning was that atropine, if self-injected within 2 minutes during battle, could be used as an antidote to nerve gas. Thus, it should not be allowed into the country in the event that the Iraqi army might choose to deploy nerve gas, handing out self-injecting atropine to each of its soldiers. One UN official pointed out, Iraqi soldiers already had gas masks, which were actually much more reliable than self-injecting atropine. But based on its very speculative reasoning, the U.S. still sought to block one of these critical drugs necessary for all major surgery. As malnutrition stayed at high levels, UN agencies worked with Iraq to increase food animals such as sheep and goats. At one point, a UN agency recommended that Iraq import vaccines for enterotoxemia, a disease found in sheep and goats that's endemic in Iraq. The U.S. blocked these on the grounds that Iraq might use goat vaccines to produce biological weapons. The U.S. was alone in this policy. While the U.K. was in lockstep with the U.S. on votes and other matters, even the U.K. only blocked about 1/20th the amount of the humanitarian goods as the U.S., and from 1995 on, no other member of the Security Council blocked any humanitarian goods at all. From the time the Oil for Food program began operating in 1995 until March 2003, U.S. blocking of humanitarian goods increased continuously, growing from $150 million to over $5 billion, even in the face of growing international protests and repeated condemnation and criticism from within the United Nations. In the end, because of the U.S. measures blocking humanitarian goods and blocking Iraq's equipment for oil production, a total of only $28 billion in humanitarian goods was actually delivered to Iraq over the entire 8-year period. That came to less than $180 per person per year for everything, including food, medicine, and the reconstruction of the infrastructure, or about 1/2 the per capita of income the poorest country in the Western, the income of Haiti, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. All other trade by Iraq, however innocuous, was criminalized. How did the U.S. policymakers arrive at these positions? I interviewed at length a number of people within the U.S. government involved in the process, from desk officer to the ambassadorial level. I also read all the reports of the Congressional Research Service and the General Accounting Office that described this process, and then did FOIA requests to those agencies to get the original transcripts of the interviews that they had conducted. The consistent picture that emerges is that the U.S. process was one that deliberately maximized delays and denials. Import contracts were circulated to several dozen technical experts who could find a potential military use for absolutely anything. There were a few people who were concerned about political risks, primarily from the International Organization's office within the State Department. But overall, quote, there was no incentive to let goods through. There were not a lot of tears shed about what Saddam was not getting. And there was no incentive, there was the sense that Saddam needed to be pressured to the max, and there was no incentive to ease up. As far as I can tell, there was never anyone who introduced the notion that Saddam and the Iraqi population were actually distinct entities. The discussion always took place in terms of, quote, denying Saddam. When I interviewed the U.S. officials involved, there's one question that I asked of each of them. Did the U.S. use a risk-benefit analysis only? A risk-benefit analysis or risk analysis only? In reviewing a contract for water trucks, for example, did the U.S. look at the benefit of bringing water trucks into Iraq given the urgent problems with the lack of potable water, and weigh this against the risk envisioned by the U.S.? Or did U.S. officials ask only, is there any conceivable way that water trucks can have a military use? Interestingly, every U.S. official I asked said, risk analysis only. Quite literally, the humanitarian impact was not part of the decision-making calculus. One of the central technical experts in the U.S. review process, Major Robert von Tersch, was known for taking some of the most extreme positions. Von Tersch was a biochemist for the Army who worked for the State Department's Non-Proliferation Bureau, coordinating the weapons review of import contracts. He justified the U.S. decision to prohibit Iraq from importing equipment for a cheese factory by describing how it might use it, how the Iraqi government might use it to produce weapons of mass destruction. Making cheese requires fermentation equipment, which in turn could be used to grow pathogens. Therefore, cheese-making equipment could be used to produce biological weapons. On one occasion, he argued that Iraq should not be imported, should not be permitted to import chicken eggs. He found the import contract for chicken eggs to be suspicious on various grounds. Egg yolks can be used as a growth medium in which it could be possible to cultivate biological strains, which might then be used in biological weapons. Furthermore, according to von Tersch, the United States did not have evidence that Iraq had enough incubators to hatch the eggs. While it is true that egg yolks can be used as a growth medium in which to cultivate biological strains, Iraq was already producing over 600 million eggs per year. So presumably, Iraq had found some way to incubate the eggs, despite von Tersch's skepticism. And while the poultry production wasn't enough to meet Iraq's nutritional needs, 600 million eggs per year meant that each Iraqi, on average, received only 24 eggs annually. One would think that 600 million eggs already provided enough egg yolks for the government to meet the needs of its biological weapons program. When I asked one State Department official why the humanitarian impact was not a factor in the U.S. decision-making process, he said, it wasn't our job, it wasn't part of our skill set. So I asked, so whose job was it? He said, it was the UN's. I said, but the UN did its job and did that very well. There was a massive continuous flow of reports documenting the humanitarian crisis and the impact of the holds. He responded rather angrily, you can't trust the UN, they're naive, they're in Saddam's pocket. So overall, it was a reasoning process in which the humanitarian impact was first simply excluded from the discussion at the outset, since the discussion explicitly concerned only security risks and possible military uses. There was no one whose job it was to consider humanitarian impact, and it was an institutional culture in which anyone who raised such issues would be seen as, quote, siding with Saddam. Even when information was brought to the attention of those involved in the U.S. policymaking, however extensive or well-documented the information was, U.S. officials found a series of reasons to ignore it or deny its credibility, as when they sought to undermine and discredit major humanitarian agencies or figures such as Dennis Halliday and Hans von Sponeck. Overall, in my view, U.S. officials did not act with the deliberate cruelty that's envisioned by international law. It was not a hatred of Iraqis that led U.S. officials to act as they did. It was the decision that the Iraqis would bear the cost of the United States' intractable political dilemma. This particular catastrophe did not require actual hatred. It required only the capacity of U.S. officials to believe their own rationales, however implausible they might have been, and that there be no venue in which to challenge their reasoning as casuistic and disingenuous. Madeleine Albright's memorable gaffe in response to the question, 500,000 children, is it worth it? She famously said, yes, we think it's worth it, which she regretted for years, was always and only a public relations error. It made no difference that she and other State Department officials from that point on vigorously insisted that they cared deeply about Iraqi children. The more accurate answer, regardless of the public rhetoric, was, of course it was worth it. Blocking glue, water pipes, water tankers, thermos flasks, ambulance radios, refrigerators, irrigation equipment, all of this was worth it because the negligible imaginary possibility that these could be turned to nefarious purposes always outweighed the collapse of the Iraqi health system, outweighed Iraq's efforts to increase agricultural production, outweighed the disappearance of Iraq's middle class, outweighed the hundreds of thousands of tons of untreated sewage that went daily into Iraq's rivers. However extensive the human damage, it was never enough to affect U.S. policy. The only things that brought about changes in the U.S. position were political pressure and public embarrassment, and then only slight and temporary changes. In the absence of public visibility, the United States' consistent policy was simply to do the most damage possible to Iraq's economy at every opportunity in the most extreme way possible. The U.S. systematically ensured the conditions that would make Iraq unable to provide decent conditions for human life, regardless of whatever the Iraqi regime did or failed to do. What I'd like to do now is turn to the current sanctions on Iran and look at how they compare to Iraq and what the Iraq sanctions can tell us about them. So first, the Iraq sanctions were widely criticized throughout the international community for the massive humanitarian damage they did. What followed was the development of targeted sanctions, or smart sanctions. The idea is that instead of imposing broad trade sanctions that affect an entire population indiscriminately, the Security Council and countries imposing sanctions should use measures that specifically target the leadership, blocking the purchase of weapons, or affecting the personal assets or freedom of movement of political and military leaders. The view of many political scientists and policymakers is that smart sanctions are now the norm, so there is no need to be concerned about the humanitarian effects of sanctions, since they are only affecting weapons or punishing the leadership. The current sanctions on Iran are often presented in those terms. There is no need to monitor the humanitarian impact, since the Security Council sanctions only concern Iran's nuclear program and ballistic missiles. The Security Council committee charged with overseeing the sanctions on Iran does not monitor the humanitarian effects. On the panel of experts affiliated with the Iran sanctions, there are specialists in nuclear development and ballistic missiles, but no one with the expertise or the mandate to monitor humanitarian issues. If you look at the Security Council resolutions themselves, they seem to fit the ideal of smart sanctions. For example, Resolution 1737 provides for freezing the assets of persons or companies, quote, directly associated with or providing support for Iran's proliferation-sensitive nuclear activities or the development of nuclear weapon delivery systems, close quote. Resolution 1929 requires that states prevent the transfer of technology or the provision of technical assistance to Iran if it is related to nuclear weapons or ballistic missiles. So it seems as though the sanctions on Iran are narrowly tailored to address the legitimate security concerns of the Council and the international community. But here's how they are ultimately implemented. Iranian Americans cannot send remittances to their elderly parents in Iran through any bank that operates in the United States. Capital One Bank canceled the checking account of an Iranian scholar who is in the U.S. quite legally under the Scholars at Risk program. The Canadian bank TD Bank abruptly canceled the accounts of thousands of Canadian Iranians without notice or reason. The Apple store in New York refused to sell an iPhone to someone because he was speaking Persian. And the damage is systemic, not just anecdotal. Nearly a dozen major companies have refused to sell gasoline to Iran, and the EU has joined the US and other countries in refusing to buy Iranian oil. The US, EU, and other countries have passed legislation prohibiting their nationals from shipping or receiving any cargo through Iran's major national shipping line, regardless of what the cargo is. This impacts Iran's entire GDP, the ability of the state to provide basic services, and the transportation, industrial production, and energy consumption that are fundamental to the functioning of any modern society. So how does this happen, that what seem to be narrow and legitimate sanctions in fact operate as massive systemic measures, doing damage to Iran's entire economy and the population as a whole? I'm still coming to understand this architecture, but basically I think there are five levels. First, there are the mandatory provisions of the Security Council resolutions, which reference nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles, and also impose an evidentiary requirement. States are only instructed to enforce those measures when they have information that gives them reasonable grounds to believe that a ship or person or company is carrying those weapons or funding them or manufacturing them. There are also voluntary measures that are a bit broader, but are still tied to nuclear and ballistic missiles. But then there is language that is exceedingly vague, that states should, quote, exercise vigilance, close quote, over Iranian transactions and goods, and should apply, quote, enhanced monitoring, close quote. It looks to me like these two phrases constitute the most significant operative language in the entire sanctions machinery. Because what happens is that they are invoked by the U.S. and others to justify unilateral measures that are then extreme and indiscriminate. These terms function as a kind of device of mutual deniability. The U.S. and EU, invoking the exercising vigilance clause, block all transactions to or from all Iranian banks, including the sale or purchase of ordinary commercial goods. Meanwhile, when the Committee of the Security Council that manages the Iran sanctions receive complaints that these sanctions are overbroad, they respond, the Council is not responsible for those, since the resolution itself requires ties to nuclear weapons programs. In addition to measures imposed under the rubric of complying with the Council's request for vigilance, several countries then simply impose unilateral measures. The U.S. is the most extreme, but the EU, Canada, Australia, and a couple of others are not far behind. So we see the blanket prohibition on buying all Iranian oil, on shipping any goods through Iran's national shipping company, on prohibiting all national banks and foreign banks with branches in country from engaging in any transactions with Iran, even transactions involving ordinary permissible commerce and humanitarian needs. But then I think there is one more level as well. So let's take the incident involving Capital One Bank, where an Iranian in the U.S., quite legally, has his bank account canceled abruptly without explanation. There have been similar incidents involving diplomats or UN officials working in Iran in which their bank accounts or family transfers or financial transfers to their family or to their business obligations were flatly denied. I think it's not because these banks have any particular animosity toward Iranians, but that it's simply because the banks are interested in simply doing as much business as possible. But in the last year, there were half a dozen prosecutions of banks by the U.S. Treasury Department for facilitating financial transactions or opening accounts for countries sanctioned by the U.S. And in each of these cases, the penalty paid was massive. In each case, on the order of $500 million each. A penalty last June against the Dutch bank, ING, was the highest in the history of the Treasury Department. So, by the way, the enforcement under the Obama administration is an order of magnitude more aggressive than it was under the Bush administration. Given this, it seems to me that just a normal risk-benefit analysis would dictate that the bank is better off with a very broad policy of presumptive denial, because it'll be costly and burdensome to determine the legality of each transaction, and because they can't afford to take any amount of risk given the size of the penalties. The same principle will apply to technology companies who, given the risk, will presumptively refuse to sell any goods at all to anyone who has anything to do with Iran, rather than risk a prosecution for transferring technology to someone who may, in turn, transfer that dangerous iPhone to a member of the Revolutionary Guard. Thus, on top of the broad unilateral measures, there is then a chilling effect as companies put in place policies that are so risk-averse as to function as an entire additional level of sanctions. So although the sanctions against Iraq generated demands for reform and for greater attention to humanitarian monitoring, the current sanctions on Iran avoid this accountability because, first, the mandatory provisions of the resolutions themselves are drafted narrowly with an explicit focus on ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons, so it seems that there is no need to be concerned with the humanitarian impact of blocking those weapons, while the measures that are extreme and damaging are the ones imposed through either the unilateral interpretation of the resolutions by the U.S., EU, and other countries, or by their direct unilateral measures. But as we see the rapid deterioration in Iran, the growing deprivations and difficulties, it seems to me that as a matter of conscience, it is no less urgent now to consider the legality and the morality of the humanitarian effects and to demand accountability. Thank you.
I happen to witness the 1953 embargo and sanctions against Iran by the United States and United Kingdom. At that time, Iran could not sell any oil at all. And one Italian company who came to buy some Iranian oil, I make it very brief, they were stopped and they were confiscated by the British Navy and was guided to Aden port. The following of that thing was the coup against the Iranian government and the consequences that everybody probably knows. My question is this, considering those effects, why do you think they impose this kind of sanctions? Is it because they have a dirty heart or dirty mind, or they have political purposes in mind? And what are those purposes for these? Right now, Cuba has been sanctioned, suffering from embargo for past 60 years. I'm sorry, 50 some years. And the objective is quite obvious. They want the people so much trouble that somehow they raise against the regime. Don't you think the same thing is the objective of this, regardless of any humanitarian concern?
You know, I think the thing about sanctions is that they are so attractive to the countries that impose them. And by the way, 70% of all sanctions are imposed by the U.S., and it's because it's something that plays well to the domestic audience, and that the damage done is both off of our books, it's not on our budget, there's no damage, there's not the risk that you see with military intervention, and the damage is far away. So it sort of, first of all, seems like, so it's very politically attractive, it's very easy to do, there's very little natural constituency in the U.S. that will oppose it, whereas if you go to war, then there's a much higher level of demand and interest and demand for explanation and interest than simply causing economic harm, which seems abstract and it's sort of easily diminished on some people very far away. And the only Americans who would suffer from it for the most part are going to be the companies that are doing business in that particular sector with that particular country. So it's very different than saying we are going to go to war in a way that costs us $12 billion a month, which is the number. Is it 12 a month?
$2 billion a day.
No.
It's $2 billion a week, isn't it?
No, the figure that we use is, believe it or not, you may not believe it, $12 billion per month was the cost of maintaining
in Iraq
the military, the U.S. military in Iraq. $144 billion a year was the cost that we had identified. Yeah.
So clearly, that has much greater domestic political costs and raise much more indignation and much more questioning than if you simply say, here's a policy that doesn't cost the taxpayers anything, and it doesn't seem like it's violent. That's the thing about sanctions. It doesn't seem like they're violent because it's not planes and bombs and guns and missiles. But of course, when you undermine someone's health, when you see child mortality increasing, when you see malnutrition increasing, when you hear stories about people not only losing their jobs, but in the case of Iraq, selling parts of their home, stories of people selling parts of their door frames and their window frames, and looking at diseases coming about through vitamin deficiencies that had not been seen since in Iraq for decades, then of course that's violence. Of course that's violence. But the thing is, it's so attractive for a country like the U.S., and the U.S. is overwhelmingly the dominant user of sanctions, because it sounds like you're doing something more than mere diplomacy, without raising any of the issues of accountability or questions or objections that would come from military intervention.
Dr. Gordon, you mentioned conscience at the end of your talk. I got to spend some time, I think, with others in this room too, learning from Kathy Kelly, who's in Chicago. And I wonder if either of you or both of you could speak to the role of ordinary citizens in the United States speaking out on behalf of conscience. And as we see sanctions used on other countries, the U.S. is still using them today, both of you mentioned, how do we as ordinary people live authentically and bring awareness to issues like this? Do we have a role?
I mean, obviously I'm not a U.S. national and I don't live here, but I want to give an answer that goes beyond the U.S. First of all, I want to say I had in my office in Baghdad more Americans visiting than any other country, any other country. Spain, Italy, and the U.S. U.S. was number one. But for the U.S., for a U.S. national, it was much more dangerous to come to Iraq than for the others, because it was forbidden by the U.S. government to come to Iraq unless you had a humanitarian reason. So today we have court cases. I have a friend who lives in Seattle. He was fined $20,000 for bringing medicines to the Iraq under sanctions. But let us, if we do a tally now, if we do an accounting of the impact of the public voice, like Voices in the Wilderness, like Kathy Kelly in the U.S., we will be disappointed when we realize that there hasn't been that much of a difference that was made. But it would be terribly disappointing if that would lead us to conclude it wasn't worth it. It was immensely worth it. What happened in the UK, what happened in Spain, what happened in Italy, less so in my own country, where people went on the street and challenged democracy. Because in the UK, the majority of the people was against that war. And the Parliament, the House of Commons in London, acted really on their own accord, ignoring the public voice. But that message is there. People have a good memory, a better memory than we often believe. And I think it has impacted and influenced the outcry that exists now with regard to other issues as they affect the Middle East or others. So let's not get despondent now, because we haven't managed in these countries to bring about a quick political shift away from what really is a behavior for which the people who were involved are accountable. And it is not, I think, unreasonable to argue, as I did, that when you are a member of the United Nations and you have accepted this as international, that's international law. So you can't go into the UN Security Council, make policy that has implications, as we have seen in Iraq, and walk out of the UN Security Council and be free. No, you are held accountable. And that's what we are trying to do. And if people call us naive or fanatic, this is all trying to, eliminate uncomfortable voices. But the voices in the wilderness must continue. Okay, that's my answer.
My name is Sam Boland, and I spent the last year working on very closely with the United Nations mission in South Sudan. And I'll get to my question at the end, but it sounds as though a very common theme on the panel is that the influence and intervention of the U.S. is often a very negative one and really results in politicking, especially with regards to their influence within the United Nations as a member of the Permanent Security Council. Now, aside from this, one of the very clear things that I was painfully aware of was the economic waste and the waste of time inherent in the bureaucracy of the United Nations in South Sudan. I don't really think I need to convince anyone up here of how much of a problem that is, but for example, we had a training program which would cost about $3,000 per training. One of those trainings would train 15 village midwives, and our monitoring and evaluation showed that with that, each community that had one of those midwives as a member would reduce maternal mortality in a country with maternal mortality at 1 in 6 by 40%. Now, the United Nations, every individual working in UNMISS, in UNDP, in UNFPA, had access to their own private vehicle. This alone, each one costing about $120,000. They were using brand new Toyota Land Cruisers. Now, if it's a given that reducing the United States' influence as a member of this Permanent Security Council in the United Nations is necessary to productive change, as is the restructuring, the bureaucratic and economic restructuring of the United Nations, how do you see this changing? And if there is no effective answer to that, how do you justify maintaining faith in the United Nations as a credible and effective institution?
I'm not sure I
will satisfy you in my, with my answer. First of all, there's no question that there is a lot of bureaucracy in the UN and a lot of wastefulness also in the UN. That aside, I would submit to you the United Nations has many faces. The United Nations has a political face, that's the Security Council. The United Nations has 55,000 employees that are trying, often under dangerous, like in your case, circumstances to do what is expected here. And they do it, some more successful than others. That's clear. The United Nations has in the last, my students get from me a three-pager list where I identify 15 UN reform documents that have been produced by high-level panels by the Secretary Generals, Boutros Ghali, for example, and Kofi Annan, and Ban Ki-moon, that say the right things about making this United Nations more efficient, more effective. Nothing at all will happen in these days when we are entering into a colder war than that which ended in 1989 because of a, and this is now, please, I hope you accept what I say, is to a very large extent due to Western behavior. Not just the US, it is the NATO expansion into the East, trying to flirt with countries like Ukraine and Georgia to try to bring them into the fold. For what? In order to create a wall against Russia. So we are in the middle of really producing out of Europe a new, an old new enemy. The policies of the current US government and the, more than the previous government with regard to the Pacific, I submit to you, any of you who are interested, read a speech that I read last night in my hotel room by Malcolm Fraser, former Prime Minister of Australia, who talks about the fear that many Australians have that they are yet, through their defense contract agreements with the United States, are being pulled into the next war in the Pacific with China. If we cannot manage in the Western world to take that step backwards, to say we are one of, and increasingly few, what are we? We are 330 million Americans, maybe, I don't know, 70 million Canadians, and we are 500 to 600 million Europeans. Out of 7.3 billion isn't that much. And we take ourselves much too seriously based on military muscle, and we are walking from one crisis to another. The UN will not become a better institution under those circumstances. We are in an age of serious, really serious confrontation. And unless we find these wise men and women that started the United Nations, including such people as George Bundy and Eleanor Roosevelt, America led in the creation of this thing. But where is America today when it comes to multilateralism? I don't see it. And therefore, the chances are dim, very dim, that this institution will meet the expectations of people of your age, of your idealism, maybe. But that shouldn't lead you not to continue to assist the UN to be that better institution.
My name is Elizabeth Austin. Thank you for being here. I'm actually glad you brought up the U.S. and Western push to kind of a new Cold War with Russia, because that directly is, relates to my question. I published an article recently in Global Politics magazine about how the 1953 coup relates to U.S.-Iranian relations today with the sanctions. And I just wondered, I wanted your opinion kind of on my point of view, which is that the sanctions are isolating Iran, and they're forcing them to find alliances with places like Armenia, who is also isolated because of the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict and their history with Turkey. And Armenia is completely economically controlled. I mean, I did my fieldwork in Nagorno-Karabakh, and they're completely economically controlled by Russia. So do you think that we're pushing Iran to an alliance with Russia? Do you think that the U.S., Iran and Russia. Do you think that the U.S. sanctions push them in that direction because you're going Iran, Armenia, Armenia, Russia? Or do you think, because with what's happening in Syria with Russia and the U.S., clearly that's a problem. So do you think that those sanctions isolate Iran and kind of push them towards alliances they wouldn't otherwise be looking towards?
Do you want me to take care of Iran? I think what's going on in Iran right now is really astonishing. Last week I was talking with someone who lives in the U.S. She's Iranian, and she's doing a documentary on the effects of on what it's like to live under sanctions. And so she had just been in Tehran for 3 weeks. And her mother is an economist, and her father owns a publishing house. And she said, first of all, the impact of all of the cost of imports, because all imports have to now go, it's just so difficult to get anything in, the increase in corruption, the effect on civil society, the effect on political expression, there's just enormous damage in all of these ways. She was saying that a publishing house that her family is involved with, which has been in existence for, if I understood this right, generations, that they're now reduced because of issues of hard currency and the difficulty of getting paper and basic goods, is now, each book now has a press run of only 500 books, and that her family's publishing house and another publishing house owned by another family that's been close to them for many years, the both owners of publishing houses were, with a kind of gallows humor, saying, in this kind of dark, morose way, well, we're going to be under by the end of the year. Well-established publishing houses are looking to collapse by the end of the year or within a year. Bankruptcies have shot up. Middle class, all the indicators of middle class stability are eroding. So the number of people who can afford to pay the tuition to send their kids to private higher education, that's dropping, and you see kids instead going into public higher education. Or you see them not going into higher education at all. Everybody who can leave is leaving in terms of young professionals. And the corruption is much greater, because now, whereas prior to a few years ago, if you wanted to import goods for whatever your factory was or whatever your business was, you just did it. And you could be quite independent of the state and do that. And now, if you want to import anything, you have to be connected to the intelligence service, the state, or more generally, or the Revolutionary Guard. You have to either be connected to them or pay a bribe to them. And if you are not doing that, then you will not exist as a business. So that means the entire set of... So those who are independent of the state, in fact, in every regard, are diminishing. And it means that... So if you look at the sanctions on Iran by the Security Council, they list particular people in the regime, the intelligence service, and the Iranian and the Revolutionary Guard. And those are the ones who are ostensibly targeted by the sanctions, right? We are going to undermine their assets, we are going to cut off their lifeline, and so on. But from everything I'm hearing, the exact opposite is happening. All of those groups, because of the sanctions, are consolidating not only their political control, but consolidating their economic control. Parts of the economy that they would never have participated in before, they now own greater and greater shares. Ordinary things like imports of factory raw materials now result in both control and profit to those entities. So it's not just the issue of isolation, although what you said about isolation is true. I mean, and that's in spades, it's true. So I don't know if you in the audience are aware of something called the SWIFT network. So I actually think the worst damage of all of these things happen in bureaucracies that no one has ever heard of. So the SWIFT network is the financial telecommunications network by which a financial transaction happens between two banks. So imagine, here's how I sort of understand it. You write a check to me, I deposit it in my bank account, my bank then goes to your bank and presents it, and your bank pays them. So it's that telecommunications device between international banks. So in July, the U.S. succeeded, and there's only one, SWIFT network, there is only one, and it is the global network for all financial transactions that are international. So in July, the U.S. successfully persuaded the SWIFT network to cut Iran out altogether. So the isolation, you see what I mean? It's just, here's this obscure bureaucratic thing that no one has ever heard of, and it absolutely is the equivalent of cutting the air out of the economy. So this means that the only way Iran's economy can function at all is through ways that are increasingly close to criminality, or certainly viewed by the U.S. and parts of the international community as criminal. In fact, what they're doing is they have large-scale barter arrangements with India and China. I think, to some extent, Russia, but really large-scale with India and China. So they swap oil for goods. And there's a lot of questions about how successful that is, because there are certain things you can't do without hard currency. There's no way around saying that the damage from the isolation is enormous. It's indiscriminate. And if you look at, there's a great Iranian feminist collective that's writing about this stuff. They are saying if you look at all of these measures, they are increasing repression by the state. They are decreasing the political space for dissent and for criticism of state policies. If you say the point is to undermine the regime, if you say the point is to increase respect for human rights, if you say, oh, we're only doing this because we're concerned about nuclear weapons and we don't want to harm the population, all of those three things, the exact diametric opposite is in fact what's happening on a broad scale in a thoroughgoing systemic way.
I'm just going to say, because thousands of Iranians every year go to Yerevan. When I was there, there were thousands of Iranians there for a celebration of a holiday. And they're putting money into the Armenian economy, which puts money directly into the Russian economy, because Armenia only really trades with Russia. So I just didn't know if you thought the U.S. was being short-sighted in terms of the sanctions, because you're just pushing them further towards this new Cold War, Russia versus the U.S. Because all those Iranians going to Yerevan, putting money in the Armenian economy, is putting money in the Russian economy.
I don't know how much of a concern it is that some quantity of Iranian assets are going into Russia. But I do think it's short-sighted for all the reasons I mentioned, but also because all of these networks for ordinary commerce are essentially now become black market and gray market. And what we see in other sanctions regimes, whether it's Iraq or Yugoslavia or others, is that those then become the networks for real live criminal activity, not criminalized ordinary commerce. Those are the networks that then become the networks, the financial distribution, logistical networks for drug trafficking, human trafficking, and arms trafficking. Once you create these massive networks of illegal trade, of illegal trade, then they don't disappear afterwards. They then become used for purposes that are much more malevolent than buying folding chairs for Iran, because now it's a criminal activity to import them because of the U.S. measures.
What you were mentioning for Iran is exactly what happened in Iraq during the sanctions. Exactly what happened. I'm afraid we have to cut away. It is 7:30. Can we go on for another couple of questions?
Sure.
Okay, we can have another. You can come up.
Hello, and thank you. I'll be very brief. One of the things that I've tried to come to understand about the 2003 invasion of Iraq and the ensuing occupation is its intellectual history in American foreign policy circles, and the priorities being very much oriented towards bringing Iraq into a world market economically, and also fostering a sort of model of liberal democracy, very much about participating in that market. Whereas with sanction regimes, you get this diametrically opposed idea about literally cutting out the nation from that world financial market. And I was wondering, as I've learned, this inclusion into a world community of markets has a very rich, if occasion, you know, misguided and sort of bad consequences, intellectual history in the United States. What is the intellectual history of the sanctions regime within the foreign policy community, within the international relations academia, that inspires these kinds of possibilities, that inspires these kinds of patterns of behavior that foreclose the more maybe daring, like you said, daring to reason, daring to think about other possibilities for dealing with these states? You know, where is that coming from? I'm sorry if it's a vague question, but it's sort of taking it on a different tack.
The sanctions before 1990 were different creatures than sanctions after 1990. Really, from the end of World War II, so throughout the Cold War, sanctions, no one ever talked about ethics. If you look at all the literature on this, of all the people writing about sanctions, no one's talking about humanitarian impact or ethics. Just really doesn't come up at all, except slightly in the case of South Africa. But for the most part, the only thing that's talked about is, why are they not more effective? How effective are they? Effective meaning, how do you get the target state to comply more often? And in the case of the Security Council, it's really not discussed at all, because the Security Council is paralyzed, right? Of the P5, if the Soviets want something, the U.S. will veto it. And if the U.S. wants something, the Soviets veto it. So in general, the Security Council didn't do much. Much less was it at risk of overreaching. And also for the same reasons, unilateral or multilateral sanctions by nations on nations didn't do much harm. If the U.S. blockades or sanctions Cuba, it can trade with the Soviets and vice versa. So the thing is, sanctions were never comprehensive. You could never actually essentially put a ring around a country and choke it off altogether. So therefore, there weren't really significant humanitarian consequences of the sort we saw in Iraq. So therefore, nobody talked about the ethics of it. 1990 is completely different. The Soviet Union is collapsing. Russia has taken the Soviet Union's seat. It's in no position to really provide a counterweight to the U.S. And now, for the first time, both in international affairs and within the Security Council, it's possible to impose sanctions that are comprehensive, especially under Chapter 7 of the Charter, which requires every member nation of the United Nations, all 193 currently, participate in enforcing the sanctions. And the original sanctions on Iraq were almost completely comprehensive. Nothing except medicine and, to a slight extent, food was allowed in at all. So it was a kind of siege, a literal siege that had never been possible before in the history of humanity, that every single nation in the world works together to block every single thing going in or out of a country. And that's when you start to see these massive humanitarian costs, in the case of Iraq, especially coupled with the bombing. And that's when you see the big shift in how the literature also views it as something where you have to at least think about targeting. And then we see the language of targeting and the rhetoric of targeting. And now we see, it looks to me, like all the language about smart sanctions and targeting is just sort of the rhetorical dance that's done before then, in a circuitous way, implementing sanctions that are systemic and broad and indiscriminate again.
As you were making your presentation, I had the grandiose idea, and I hope everybody will forgive me, of imagining myself as the President of the United States. And I'm thinking to myself, I am trying to deal with Saddam Hussein, who I think everybody agrees was a very bad man. And Tariq Aziz was also a very bad man. And both of these men, as I have followed this over the years, were impossible to deal with. Impossible to deal with. Now, what options do I have? Do I want to go to war? No. No, I don't want to do that. Diplomacy has failed. Now we have economic sanctions. You made the presentation, both of you, Mr. von Sponeck and Professor Gordon, that sanctions were unsuccessful. They were not done right. Then I thought to myself, well, maybe we could do smart sanctions. Maybe we weren't doing the sanctions correctly. But you pointed out that smart sanctions, Professor Gordon, that didn't work either. Well, then I thought to myself, if I'm the president and I'm kind of do something with Mr. Exert Influence on Saddam and Tariq Aziz, and I say this with all seriousness, maybe I would have Professor Gordon running my sanctions program because she would know how to do it. And I say that with dead seriousness. But then you pointed out to me in almost your last remarks about how sanctions have almost inevitably, unavoidably bad consequences. So, diplomacy fails, I don't want to go to war, and sanctions don't work. Now, Mr. von Sponeck pointed out maybe the United States should be stepping back, and maybe I shouldn't even be having these thoughts about trying to control these people. Because the United States should be stepping back in the world and not exerting its influence. You spoke about the Ukraine, which my grandparents were from. They left for some interesting reasons, weren't treated very well. But that's a whole other story. So what I'm really asking is, I'm the president, explain to me what I should do. Because I really, at this point, can't figure out what the heck I should do.
Do you guys want it?
And that's a serious, serious question. I mean that with all seriousness from the bottom of my heart. What should I do? Explain to me what I should do.
Well, the first thing that I would say in response is give up your hidden agenda. There's always a hidden agenda.
What's my hidden agenda?
The hidden agenda, as far as Iraq was concerned, was what is embodied and became more transparent in November of October 1998 when the U.S. Congress, after a signature by Mr. Clinton, signed the Iraq Liberation Act. It was Iraq cooperated. One can say many things about the government of Iraq, but I negotiated with that government, and it wasn't all evil. These were intelligent people with whom we talked very concretely, and there was some progress in improving things. But the government of Iraq knew very well it could do whatever it wanted to cooperate. As long as Saddam Hussein and his government were in power, there was no chance that sanctions against Iraq would be lifted. So that dictates then the attitude of the government to cooperate. Behind the scene was something very complicated, and I can only scratch the surface. One thing that was clear, there was fermentation in the Middle East. The American situation in Saudi Arabia became more and more dicey. The U.S. needed a new anchor in order to remain in the Middle East. And a weak anchor or a weak party for a new anchor was Iraq. And so you wanted to get rid of that government in order to establish yourself. That's not what one discusses in the UN Security Council. The UN Security Council isn't there to talk about regime change, neither in Iraq nor in Libya. There's no resolution that enabled you to put into practice the Iraq Liberation Act in the multilateral context. Just like in Libya, the resolution was you intervene in order to protect the people in Libya, not regime change. But if we always approach that with a hidden agenda, that was what it really was about regime change in Iraq and in Libya. And as long as we have that, you will not, I repeat, not recreate what is so badly necessary in international relations if we want to get our global act together, and that is the creation of trust. There is no trust. Nobody trusts. I agree totally with an American diplomat who said the big problem in the world at the moment is lack of trust. So we have to give up the hidden agenda. If we don't do that, if we in the Security Council say one thing and do something else outside, sorry, it won't work. We need you, we need the US, as we need other countries in the UN. But we don't need the US or any other country, Russia or whoever, that plays a double game and is selfish. We have to become more multilateral minded. And maybe last sentence, in my days in Baghdad, we had two senior people appear in the UN Security Council, and we watched and listened very carefully. One was Lloyd Exworthy, Canadian foreign minister, who said, the UN was created in order to do that which is for the benefit of the global community. And then came out of as the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee of the US Congress, Jesse Helms, who said, if you do what we want you to do, we will support you. If you don't, we will marginalize you. With that attitude, we will have more turbulence, we will have more problems, and we will have more failures. That's my answer.
Mr. Von, can I just say one comment? Mr. Von Spanik, you've just condemned American foreign policy. But that wasn't my question. My question is, back to my question, you didn't address my question.
All right.
I'm afraid you'll have to address it out there because we have to stop now.
I'll join you. Okay, I don't evade. Okay.
Okay, thank you very much for coming and look forward to speaking.